Hey there, this is Emmett from Connected. Hope you're all looking forward to another great show we've got for you here. This is another one of our roundtables, and for those of you who've listened to them before, you know what's coming. This is a bit of a warning. If you've got someone who shouldn't be hearing, shall we say, certain types of content, it's best to not have this on a speaker in the room, listen to it privately or listen to it without them there, just giving you a heads up in advance. And given my guests this week, there probably will be strong language from the start, and there definitely will be sensitive subject matters. So that's us doing all our keeping ourselves safe and warned. It's your own fault if anything is on the show that you don't like, because I've just warned you. So accept that now. And now, onto the show. Hello and welcome to Connected, the Sunday Business Post Technology podcast brought to you in association with Dell EMC. I'm Emmett Ryan, and it is getting close to that day, V-Day as we like to call it, the day of love, Valentine's Day, where, well, it's me and two single people last I checked in the office of me right now, but that's still going to be fine because we've all had our loves and losses, and it is our annual Valentine's Day special where we talk about dating and love in the digital age, because it is such a hot topic online, frankly. And so to join me on this quest into l'amour and the commoditization in a way of it is Roisin Kiber from the team at Connected.
Hello there.
And Shauna Scott, who is, of course, the founder, CEO and overall boss of Sex Shuppa.
Hi, I'm here in the office, in the studio, your new studio.
I know.
It's so shiny and professional.
So Shauna's next to Roisin, who's like obviously on a load of our roundtables, our most frequent guest. She's our most frequent guest who isn't a regular writer for Connected, is the best way to put it. We've had her on since our very first year doing podcasts. She's never seen a studio with us. She is used to doing professional podcasts, like in head stuff and places like that, where they have concepts like production values and budgets. Admittedly, minimal budgets, but still budgets. This is Connected. We don't have those.
But listeners, picture if you can a shiny chrome walled, a kind of a fortress of sound recording. We have Nespresso machines here on the walls. Not one, but six lined up, paving the side of one of the walls. On the opposite wall, there is a large framed portrait of Emmett Ryan looking down at us. What else? There's like robots, there's AI that like there's actual like robots doing all of the recording for us.
Sex
here.
Robots.
I hear
robots.
It cost millions.
We are definitely not in a disused storage closet.
No, not
at all. Foam stuff stuck to the walls.
That's totally accurate.
Bleeding edge technology.
In fairness, we do have a nice shiny Mac and some mics.
We do have a nice.
Although we are using like novels to hold the mics to be at the right height for the people speaking.
Propped on Salman Rushdie books.
Yeah, I'm currently, my mic is on a Salman Rushdie book.
Shout out to my man, Salman Rushdie.
It's like free plug for Salman, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, as those of you who are familiar with the show will be aware, we do our roundtables every now and again, and we discuss some major issues. Last year, our Valentine's Day issue went over a storm with all of you, so we figured we've got to make a thing out of this because it was so much fun to do as well for us. So we're going to discuss the various ways that tech is interfering with love, or maybe influencing love, or maybe aiding love along the way. And we're going to go over a few topics which might two guests are fairly well versed in, and on very different levels, I should add as well, because even looking at the topics here, my running order, I know one of them knows one better than the other. I see another one, and the other one knows that better than the other. So we've got a few things to get through, but we're going to begin with something that's kind of topical, and spoilers ahead, a Black Mirror episode from the current season, Hang the DJ. And, well, Shauna had a great blog post about this. I'm going to ask her about this in a second, but what I found interesting, Shauna, was your headline in it was basically why we're bad for loving that episode. I've got to be honest, I hated it from the start.
Really?
Yeah, so, but like, Shauna, you explain about your post and what...
No, I want to hear about why you hated it first.
Honestly, I felt like, oh, totalitarianism and love. Because it is basically for the basic premise, which I'm going to do the bad version of, and Shauna will explain in much greater detail than me, I'm sure. At least more illuminating detail, not greater detail, is essentially with this couple who are in this world where everybody uses this dating app which will find your perfect match at a 99.8% chance. But the thing is, you get told the end of the relationship, how long you've got at the very start, and you've no choice in the matter. This is how everybody gets paired up, and it goes on and on until you eventually find your perfect couple. There is a twist ending, which we might get to in this show, but it's a Black Mirror episode. Of course there's a twist ending, which involves oodles of AI as well. Now, the whole love being totalitarian thing, I just couldn't buy into, I could see what they were trying to do, but I just couldn't buy into it as an episode from the start, because it's a case of one of two things is going to happen. Either they're going to rebel and win, or rebel and fail. and you know, or else they'll do, oh, see, one of three things. Or the third one is they won't and they'll be miserable. As it turned out, I was kind of wrong on all fronts. In one respect, they did rebel, but they didn't win, and they didn't fail technically either.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting that you couldn't really buy into it, because if you think about it, aren't we already there? Mm. Aren't we already, like, with, you know, the vast majority of people on Tinder and OkCupid, like, are we not, like, already very much reliant on an algorithm to tell us who our best matches?
Well, that's always been my main beef with Tinder, that, like, it doesn't make any effort to pair you up with people apart from just that they're local and vaguely fuckable. Like,
that's true.
And I always thought that was kind of heartless and horrible. But now, watching that episode, it really made me appreciate the lack of intrusion on Tinder's part, that it does just rely on sort of animal attraction to a few pictures, which may be heavily edited slash not actually featured. That, like, the person will be in a crowd with a few other better looking people who you kid yourself it's them or something.
Yeah.
But no, actually, like, yeah, that, if anything, that was a sort of an argument against OkCupid.
Yeah.
And sort of the death knell of a certain type of dating app.
Yeah, and Match.com would be a similar principle as well.
Right, and Plenty of Fish as well, right? Although OkCupid is the one that has the really, really developed data mining operation.
Oh, yeah. OkCupid is the one that's, like, hardcore on that front. Of course, all of them, well, I think Puff might be, but most of them have the same owner as well.
Yeah, they're all owned by the same people.
IAT own them all, like, you know, so, but yeah. But, like, so, Shauna, one thing, and actually, you do have to spoil it because of the ending is actually kind of crucial to what we're discussing today, is it turned out it was all a simulation.
Yeah. So, at the very end of the episode, where the couple rebel, they've decided that they're not going to end the relationship based on what the app is telling them the end of their relationship should be, or the time at which, like, the relationship will end. So they decided to climb the giant 1,000-foot wall out of the world, and they get halfway up the wall and realize that it was all a simulation. The world falls apart. And they're shown in a black void.
It's like a holodeck.
What's a holodeck?
From Star Trek Next Generation.
Oh, guys, can I just... tangent. Did someone have sex with Data in Star Trek? I was
listening
to a podcast
in the first season.
Yeah.
And then she dies.
She dies not because of having sex with Data, though.
Spoiler alert.
Are you sure it wasn't that?
Definitely not.
Yeah.
Are you sure, like, she didn't catch some sort of robotic
didn't
STD?
Wait, didn't the puddle kill her?
The puddle, the puddle that was actually pure evil killed her.
It wasn't Data's puddle.
It wasn't Data, no. Cause so the reason Data and her end up even having sex, we're going into special places here in this podcast.
I just heard about this today, actually, from another podcast.
A space virus that nearly destroyed the entire Enterprise because they all sort of lost their minds.
Everybody got horny.
It wasn't just horny, though. Everybody kind of got crazy as well. Like, you know, it was all sorts of extremes. Like, there was horny, there was violent, there was, like, you know, which I suppose there is ties
Isn't
to that.
Isn't that lovely, though, that Data actually got laid?
Yeah.
In the first season as well.
It's
and
really
also, he had a girlfriend at one point as well in one episode where it was a woman on the rebound from a breakup.
Oh.
And, like, she broke up with him eventually when he was about to break up with her. And that was honestly far less interesting because it was kind of played for laughs with the Tasha thing. They were trying to play this for a look at Data dealing with humanity, and it was really a throwaway episode.
Aww.
And I've watched a lot of Star Trek, as anyone who's even read half our headlines in the magazine will know. But so again, back to the...
Anyway, holodeck, yeah,
holodeck.
Yeah. So essentially, they're on this holodeck thing. There are 999 other versions of themselves. They realize what has happened, which is it's a simulation, the world falls apart. And then based on how many rebellions happen... that's your percentage match for the person. So with that particular couple, there was 99.8. So 998 rebellions were recorded. And then from that, that was the couple in real life, that was their percentage match.
And, like, so, yeah, it jumps then to the female in the couple, and she goes, right, and she sees him across the bar, and he's seeing the same, and it's like, and now they're going to meet in real life. But there's the whole, like, you got, so, because this AI...
So what I didn't like about it, so the whole premise of my blog post was that this was kind of tipped to be the next San Junipero.
Right.
For anyone who watched last season, San Junipero was, like, the big romantic love story, and I didn't like... that people loved this and wanted this to be the next San Junipero. I understand why, because when I was watching Hang the DJ, I did get those warm, fuzzy feelings.
Mm.
But then when I thought about it for like 10 minutes after, I was like, why? This is wrong. This goes against everything
I think that was really, really interesting that you linked. Obviously, I should have occurred to me that to link the two, and that they have that they occupy the same place between the violence and the dystopia and the just utter nihilism that often Black Mirror resorts to.
As Shauna's saying in her piece,
it comes along at the same
point
in
violent
the
episodes.
Yeah. There is a scene at the end of San Junipero, which I feel like I probably talked about last time I was on this show at Valentine's Day, so sorry if I'm repeating myself, but there is this scene which has literally haunted me from San Junipero, which is very, very near the end. You see just a data center, and there are no humans in the shot at all, and you see a robot just take out like a little sort of stick with the information of this woman's life and put it beside the other woman's, and like that's just like the end of the story, like happy ever after. But it's really creepy because after all this human warmth and like this very human love story, albeit against a kind
everyone's
of surreal
in her house.
They are just data, like they are, and it's utterly cold. And even though is it Belinda Carlisle is playing, and you're kind of, you know, you're really feeling it, it's actually kind of a shot of coldness in the middle of all this warmth, because you're like, Jesus, like this is a humanless landscape that we've handed over our lives to and our hearts to,
but I suppose compare that
with the world of this episode, they've handed all that over from the start.
Yeah. But I suppose in the case of San Junipero, you can see it from the other way around, and that like in a cold world where it's just like people's data in a warehouse, there's still humanity there. There's still love there.
But only on the terms of the people you've handed over your soul to. And that's what's really creepy. Like, I think around the time that I watched San Junipero, I read the most recent Don DeLillo book, which is called Zero K. You know that one? And it's literally just, it's a very cold narrative about people dying and being frozen cryogenically. And the whole kind of ringing truth all the way through it is, this is for the wealthy. Immortality is for the wealthy. Yeah. And people who aren't too bothered about their soul either, even though they want to live forever, it's because they want to live forever. It's not that they want to go to an afterlife, so they're not too worried about the morals of, like, it's a whole other approach to the afterlife essentially.
And one thing I really want to ask Shauna about, because the living part is what I think annoyed me with this, because you got two aspects. One, it's because these AI have clearly, in the universe of this show, developed consciousness. They're sentient. Yeah, developed consciousness, but also they've done all the hard work, like, and you know, now I don't know about y'all, but like I haven't had a relationship I enjoyed where I didn't go through the rough patches, like where I didn't go through the learning about the other person, as in like learning why thing I do, okay, it's almost always snoring with me, or else leaving crap around the house, like, you know, why that annoys them, like, you know, but up to the big stuff obviously as well. Like, I can't imagine a relationship where I didn't have to experience with that person to know I wanted to be with them. Well, and to know they could get over that.
That's kind of what I said in my blog post, is that like love is based on personal growth, and if you don't have that, if your relationship is based on this algorithm where all the work has been done for you,
it's terrifying, like, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of scary.
I have a friend who got married, and when I was very inept, it was a few years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I would like to think I'm a little more tactful now, but I was like, I can't imagine. I said to him when he told me he was getting married, I was like, I can't imagine staying with someone for the rest of my life. Like, how are you going to do that? And he just goes, well, that's the challenge. And when I saw the ladder, I remembered him, because it was kind of like, oh, so you're not actually saying happily ever after. You're just saying, here's this massive challenge that we're taking on. So maybe like going up the ladder is only the start.
Yeah.
So the whole idea is that the algorithm's taking all that out. But it's still, yeah, it's still mind-blowing.
I suppose, I know Roshan hasn't seen this episode, but the other one within there, which I know you had a lot of good thoughts on as well, Archangel, one of the preceding episodes, I think it is the preceding episode, and because AI is basically the theme of this season's Black Mirror. There's always a tech element to it, but this one's heavy AI season.
Yeah, yeah.
And essentially, so, give you the boring Ben Kissel version of a plot explanation. It's someone gets a chip put in their head. In fact, Catherine Sands joked to me on Twitter earlier, calling me a chiphead. Thanks, Catherine. You actually are very good. It was in good jest as well, I should add. But essentially, and it means her mother, because the mother's very overprotective, and this person's like 6 or 7 at the time, and can see through her eyes and can filter out the world and stuff. And the mom realizes after a while that the kid, you know, isn't growing as a person, so agrees talking to a doctor / therapist, who's a guy who was in Bones, by the way, random small fact, that, yeah, she should stop using and just put it away. But then as she hits her teenage years, and she's out one night and mom doesn't know where she's gone home, she starts watching, and the big spoiler is she watches her daughter through her own eyes having sex with a boy, and that leads to everything terrible going on. And so that's the thing, like, that excessive control, like, will we even allow young people to mature? Because, you know, youth mistakes in love are really, really important for maturing as a person, I think.
Yeah, what I loved about that episode in particular is you can really, and any of the episodes involving the love between parents and their children, is there's just such great empathy on both sides. You do feel really empathetic for the mother, because it's at the very start of that episode, she loses her daughter, like, in a park, and it's, like, really traumatic. The entire neighborhood and the police are out looking for her. And it just becomes this, and because she's a single parent as well, there's like that extra added trauma, so that's why she has the chip implanted in her daughter. And you can understand, like, if you have a child who's troubled because of this chip, there's just that wanting to give your child privacy, but then wanting to make sure they're okay, and could parents reasonably give their child enough privacy if they had this technology to watch them the entire time?
And, like, you know, because, like, I've got a Hive camera in for review right now in work. Like,
what's
so
that?
It's basically, it's a security camera, but it's also a child watching camera.
Yeah.
You know, which, fortunately, I've got no kids, so the only people I'll be using it on are the various species of bacteria that live in my house. But it's like, I am a slovenly, terrible person.
You'd be literally watching things rot, you mean? Through this camera.
Well, okay, let's not try and...
Mold slowly growing on dishes in your sink.
This is our V-Day episode. I'm trying not completely ruin my chance of ever having a date again, but... I do dishes, okay? But one of the things I was getting to with that is, like, a lot of the technology, like Brooke refers to in these, like the dating app and like the sort of the Archangel, we're not a million miles away from it yet. Like,
no, we're not. And I think in some ways we've kind of... not necessarily that we have that particular technology, but, like, we're kind of there with parents anyway. I can't remember, what was the study that was done in the UK a few years ago that was, like, children, the amount of time spent outdoors for children because of like video games and stuff.
They just don't go out anymore.
They don't go outside, and parents feel very much... that they shouldn't go outside, or they shouldn't go wandering, they shouldn't go walking down to the park
right.
on their own.
I think that's really interesting. Something that's like a common thread. So I haven't seen the new Black Mirror season at all. I used to be a fanatic and I kind of just fell off, and I've only seen Hang the DJ, which I watched for this. But listening to you talking about it, what seems like to me is one of the, even though AI runs as a theme, the other thing is like the politics of seeing. Like, technology is always cast in this sort of biblical light in Black Mirror by Charlie Brooker, this idea that, you know, it's the knowledge that we can't undo. Like, we can't give back now that we have it. Now it is this sort of, it's been turned loose upon the world for better or for worse. But one thing technology does let you see is it lets you see things maybe you don't want to see, like you see too much, and then you get used to seeing, and you think you don't have any control, and that the person is in danger when you can't see them. Like, if your phone, I right now have a weird situation where my phone battery just keeps dying because I updated it. But basically, like, people freak out when they can't reach you, but they may not have even known that for a week before they couldn't reach you. But the minute they try to reach you, they think, like, oh my God, she's dead.
And I'm definitely in that. Like, I talk to my friends every single day, like in different like WhatsApp groups.
Right.
And if I don't hear from them for like a day or two, I start to worry.
Yes. And the other thing.
And then I'm checking their social media. Have they updated their social media? Are they dead?
Well, that's my buddy Motion. Israel's the exact same. Like, he knows if I'm not chatting away to him on Facebook, I'm so slammed at work, I'm going crazy. And like, so I'll every, you know, day or two, if it's during a crazy period, Motion will send a, hey buddy, are you okay? And it's like, this buddy of mine in Tel Aviv, like, you know, who I'd see like once a year in person at work stuff. And like, he can tell purely from my inactivity that like, I'm probably really...
Having a hard time,
like, you know.
And the other weird thing then is right now, like, okay, so we're all single then, but I guess I'm kind of seeing someone right now, but I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
I hope he doesn't hear this. But it's
does
at that stage.
Does he follow you on Twitter? Because I really do need you to retweet the episode.
Yeah, I will. I promise I will. But one thing that's playing out is like, I talk to this guy in like DMs a lot, and it always says seen. And it's fucking with my head.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I know you can turn it off, but I've just not figured out how. And in a sense, I'm not sure if I want to turn it off or not, because I just don't want to even think about it too much.
That's actually one of the reasons I don't pay for the premium of OkCupid.
Yeah.
Because with OKC, if you've got the premium, you know if they've read the message.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'd rather like, it's kind of, it's a level of even I don't want to see.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if I'm WhatsApping Shauna, she knows it's me having the chat. And if I'm checking she's seen, the odds are making sure she's on time for the podcast. If I'm messaging someone on OKC, there's a clear, I would like to engage in some level of romance with you. And if I'm checking out like mad, it's kind of going, I am a terrible person who's really kind of too into this for my own liking, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not even that you're terrible, it's that like you're conditioned to act that way, you know?
Yeah, so. And sometimes it, like, there was a kind of wave of social networking apps and dating apps that were framing voyeurism as a kind of romance, where it was like the first wave of the location-based apps were all about, you know, this person is really near you.
Mm.
Then you might as well go up and talk to them. Go on, talk to them in real life. It's real-time engagement. And it's like, no, it's not. It's just spying on people who you are kind of creeping on.
So
imagine if it gets to the point where like you have to pay not to be seen on a map or something.
Yeah,
I'm sure they're going that way. And like if you even look at Happn, like now I've
installed
and deleted Happn a bunch of times because I hate the UI, to be honest.
What's Happn?
Happn is I think it is owned by the grand overlords of dating apps as well.
Okay.
But it is the most geolocation of all geolocation apps. So it'll like tell you someone's like 50 meters away type thing.
No.
Like, you pass by.
No.
Exactamundo on your response is what my thought was as well.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, it's like, did you walk by this person? Do you know? It's like what? It's bad. And this is actually, in fairness, leading to our next topic, which is, as I phrased it on our list, although I'm being harsh into one big brand. It's a bit harsh because it's
polarized.
A lot more than them, but is Google killing love? And this doesn't refer to Google on their own, but more sort of, you know, that collation of data we have between the OKCs and the Bumbles and the Match.coms and between what Google has and what it does for your search interests and all that. And Amazon are doing the exact same, like loads of people are doing the exact same, but it's all coming together in this mishmash. And Roisin, you read this and you said it around.
Oh,
to
yeah, I linked you guys to a
piece in the Paris Review. Had
the
a good reading earlier.
Of enamoration, and it's loosely about Roland Barthes. It's by this guy called Alfie Bowen, who has books about PlayStation and psychoanalysis, who you should look up. He's really cool. But this one particular was about love and Google and how we even talk about love, like, you know, love at first sight. But what if sight, like the place, the romantic setting of meeting this person who you want to spend the rest of your life with, is your Facebook feed, or, you know, is framed within Google search results, like, and how much of kind of what is love? Because it comes back to that Black Mirror episode, actually, that like this framing in Hang the DJ of like every love is a rebellion, you know, that like it has to be the thing that they don't want you to have and that you really want and you're willing to work for. But then what if like it's all made too easy by algorithms like this? So there's that piece, the screen of enamoration. The other thing I should have sent to you guys, but I didn't want to spam you, was this amazing other piece last year by Quinn Norton called Love in the Time of Encryption. And it's about this woman conducting a relationship.
I just made an ooh face there, Roisin, by the
way. An entire relationship through encrypted apps, so that every time they talk, it disappears afterwards, and it's completely inaccessible. And the whole idea is that, like, you know, does it mean more because it's private, or does it mean more because it plays out in public on social media as kind of the more sort of capitalist cyberspace, where it could be readily interfered with?
And I really like the ephemera of it as well, that it's there and it's gone.
Yes.
And you have to appreciate it while it's there. It's it's not like WhatsApp where you can like go through your old messages and kind of reminisce on like, oh, that was what it was like, you know, a couple months ago.
Yeah. And if it's through an encrypted app, there's less context. Like, you're not looking at a little like picture on their Facebook profile, which you come to associate with them, or, you know, you can see who they're talking to. It's more like an isolated space to build. Because I think so much of like... of love specifically is about mythologizing that person in your head. But then like what Alfie Bowen makes the point is that like it's all within the context of a timeline. If you conduct it, say, over Facebook or Twitter, you see it in direct proximity to their political views or the media that they're consuming or the commercial products that they're consuming and who their connections are. While if it's isolated, like Quinn Norton is experimenting with in this piece, it's just pure in a sense. Or is it, you know, maybe this is all kind of beside the point and love is something that is untouched by technology.
But I love the idea in that article that you sent us, that no matter what, love is political. Whether you, like, so many people try to separate love from politics, but it's very much political.
Yeah, and that Black Mirror episode sort of, that was the kind of infuriatingly impossible thing. Like, relationships don't happen in a vacuum in this mystery kind of bland universe of the same restaurant, the same fields to walk across, and then this house in which they're expected to have sex after just meeting. You know, they
that
don't
house,
happen
though,
in isolation.
That it's fireplace.
It's a good house.
So nice.
Good
it was
lamp.
It was definitely a place where we're kind of going, oh yeah, quiet weekend away, you know, high from the world. It actually reminded me of a place I went to in not too far from where Sean is from, in Olympia, Washington.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, kind of go and it's like, well, hey, local reference.
Are you from Washington?
I'm from Washington. Yeah.
I went to Washington for a relationship.
Did you?
Once, years
ago. What part of Washington?
Potomac.
Okay.
Yeah, or like on the Potomac.
Oh,
the river.
Yeah.
She's Washington State.
You're the Washington that legalized weed.
Yes.
Washington. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's different.
Still cool. Getting back to where we were though. So, because I think one of the things I was pointing out, because the politics is very important here, is that, like, are the apps sort of, you know, almost refining the politics a little too much and taking love out of the politics almost, if you know what I mean? Like, the politics of love are being de-loved in a way, I think, is one of the things we're kind of arguing, like, because it's a case of, you know, it'll match me up with, you know, I'll use a name that isn't Roisin or Shauna, so Emmetella, because Emmet is not the female of Emmet, believe it or not. They are wholly unrelated names etymologically. Hey,
it's Emmetonia, actually.
Okay, so get matched up with Emmetonia, and I'll be seeing that Emmetonia has similarish interests, like, you know, whatever. And I'm, you know, I see the percentage match, then I go into the questions. This is totally okay, see, I'm describing here, but we are seeing a lot of them go down that route, and I'll go, oh, that's a red line issue for me, and I'll immediately wipe them out. And you might go, well, isn't that how you deal with someone in real life? Yeah, but the difference is I get to know them first and work out if it really is a red line issue or something I can get over.
That would be an actual tragedy. And I know I'm going to make some enemies by saying this, but, like, I have actually, like, so many stories of hooking up with people who have, like, the most odious political views to me, or who sometimes I find out, like, in retrospect, there's just some weird, and, like, it's always what, like, drives the relationship apart, you know? But, like, it is kind of funny. Like, you shouldn't just... You know, like, the filter bubble should not apply to your dating life, I think. I know that's bad.
I really love Dan Savage's advice that liberals should always fuck conservatives.
Yeah.
Not always, but, like, fuck conservatives because you can
just
fuck,
once even.
Fuck the conservative out of them. And so I was kind of... So I had a friend who came to me. She moved to the UK recently. And she was like, I'm dating someone. I'm like, okay, why are you so, why is it so fraught? Why do you say it like that? And she's like, you're not going to like him. And I was like, why? And she was like, he's a Tory. And I'm like, okay. And she was like, he likes to be fucked in the ass. And I was like,
well, that's all the more entertaining.
I know. I was like, just go for it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can work on him. You can work on his political views.
But it also, like, that is your thing you're both touching on very well there, is that because of dating apps, we assume that it's the absolute of the person, that they will never change or evolve. And it doesn't just refer to the politics, but it's everything about them.
I ended up researching that actually only this weekend. It was for a book review, which I've written for the Sunday Business Post.
But well, this, hey, this plug.
Read my book review.
Possibly coming out before this podcast, but that's another story.
Oh, yeah, it will have, yeah. Read it. It's in your home. No, but there's this thing called the end of history illusion. And it mainly affects teenagers, people... specifically at the middle of their lives, and then the elderly. Mm-hmm. So in between, apparently, you develop a bit of moderation. But it's this idea that, like, you can look back on the past and be like, oh, I've changed so much, but you can't accept that you'll change again. Like,
yeah.
Oh, I've arrived at my absolute perfect self, and this is exactly who I am now, and I'll never want anything other than what I am. And that's just not true. Like, we change.
I was going to say, it's like, because, like, you know, because, like, obviously I'm a bit older than both of you. Like, you know, it's like more old than Roisin than Shauna, but not giving away anybody's ages. I am, of course, Methuselah at 36. But, you know, it's kind of going, I think of me at 25, I think of me at 28, and I think of me at 36. And I'm kind of going, people I dated when I was 28 would never date 25-year-old me. Likewise, you know, 25-year-old me would never have dated the people I dated in my early 30s,
yeah.
And goes around like that. And it's kind of going, like, we all evolve as people, and I don't just mean that we get... It doesn't mean we get better, it just means we get different.
It would get different,
and also we learn so many lessons in every different... Like, every...
Exactly.
From relationships,
yeah. And, like, learning how to...
like, we are the big data collector, much more than the app is.
Yeah.
That's true. We become the sum of those people.
That's deep, Emmett.
I mean, it's kind of sad, too, because, like, you can't really have a relationship without projecting all your past relationships onto them just a little bit.
That's true.
I'd love to deny it and say that doesn't happen, but...
I always say it's parts of them rather than the whole thing is the thing, because it's always...
Yeah.
It's part... Because, like, obviously, also, your brain would go crazy, so if you project the whole of it, like, it's, like, data overload. Like, you know, you'd have, like, one of those, like, 404 error messages. Okay, I'm getting way too nerdy here now. But, like, yeah, no, but they're always, like, there's parts of it, but they stay with you and they help form part of who you are, so that's why they affect the relationship.
Was that in Hang the DJ, actually? Like, you see him at one point sitting out on the grass, and he's like, well, at least I learned this or something. Is that like the coach asks him for what he's taken from the past film?
Well, there's also the bit where he's like, you know, with one of his relationships in between, where, again, we were spoiling like hell, he's getting head from a woman, he's chatting away, and, like, you assume she's bored as heck, he's like, no, because she, well, at least the AI version of her has been going down the same route. So she gets tired of giving oral, essentially, and so they start having, you know, missionary, from what I recall, and basically they start talking through their problems while sexing, which is kind of interesting. They're talking through their old relationships. That's like sort of the ultimate explanation of the whole working through past relationships stuff. But it is kind of interesting how they do it in the episode. Like, I don't know, it's like, I suppose one of the things that jumped out to me as well with that, and probably went biased, is that the one before and after were way better, basically. And like you were saying, I wanted it to be Sanji and Apeiro.
Yeah, yeah. I did really love that scene. And I think, like, the more and more... Like, I do really like Hang the DJ. It just wasn't my favorite episode in the series. But like we were saying, I think there's just so much humanity in it that does ring true. But what I didn't like about it was more the audience reaction to it, and that, like, oh, it's so romantic. And it's like, it's not, though. Yeah, there's a lot of people, like, on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
I think this is just Stockholm effect, Stockholm syndrome, because Black Mirror is so unrelentingly nihilistic, mm-hmm. that to even have the slightest hint of humanity and romance about it is probably just so shocking that they're like, oh my god, this is the best episode.
Oh, that's because Sanji and Apeiro, I remember talking to a buddy of mine, Ina, who was like, you know, when I said, oh, at least I had one happy ending. And she was kind of going, you think that's the happy ending? Like, you know, it's like, you know, she was describing what you were saying about the whole cold. I was kind of going, oh, yeah.
You know, it's really interesting.
I still love
it. I think
that
it's
episode.
A happy ending. But
it is. So historically, lesbians never get happy endings.
That's also true. Yeah,
in literature and film, like, they always die. They always die.
It's basically that and Carol, essentially.
Yeah, like, Carol stands out. So this was a kind of. It was a big deal.
And you also watch Carol. Carol's freaking brilliant.
Oh, it's amazing. It's
like, I still haven't seen Carol.
Well,
thanks
to be honest,
you
love it. It's so good.
Oddly, we haven't, despite saying that, which is the odd part.
There's a lot more to it than that.
There's, like, a lot more to it. Like, you know, it's like, the important part is they don't both die, which is a crucial, which is what normally happens with lesbian relationships in cinema. It's
there
ridiculous.
There is a gun, though. There is a gun in Carol at one point.
But it's like, you know, also, frankly, if Kate Blanchett's in it, you probably should be watching it. She's just ridiculously good.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to go a little bit more to the traditional connected listener for a reason here. A lot of my buddies are married or have been in long-term relationships since before the app age. Like, some of them remember Another Friend and Powership and those, but, like, what we would know as online dating today is alien to them as a thing to use. A few of them might have used Love Groove purely from the matchmaking side, but still have oodles of questions, talked to loads of them about it before this, because I needed to get some people who aren't familiar's input, because we want listeners who aren't that familiar as well. And, you know, it's like, actually, before I get into that, I actually once met the guy just before Christmas who was one of the founders of Another Friend.
Okay.
Which is, and I had to ask him, obviously, did he see the business going the way he did? Because he's in a different sector now. And he goes, I could always see it going mainstream, but if you tell me the size and the app-based and all that, not at all, because we didn't know what apps were back then, and no way I saw the size and the whole free model. You just didn't, you know, the freemium model as it really is.
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes, no way, I could have totally seen it going mainstream in some way, definitely, like, becoming an accepted thing. Because obviously back then, dating online was still sort of a weird thing you didn't admit to your friends about. You know, we're talking like this is like the end of the last decade, starting this decade.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't that long ago.
So much stigma.
Well, like, I think I said it last time we were here, like, when I joined OkCupid for the first time, my mom was like, what are you doing online dating? That's for weirdos.
Yeah. I was just out with a friend for lunch there who met her, I think they're married or they're engaged or something, but she tells everyone they met at a flea market. They actually met online.
But, like, even remember, like, the early days of Tinder, like, the people, loads of people having their profile will tell people we met in Coppers or something like that. Like, you know,
they'd have
a line like that for if
say
if
where you went
out
on the first date rather than saying that you actually met on the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But so the meeting someone via an app is a big question. A lot of people I know who've never used them is because they have a lot of IT security questions, essentially, which is kind of far more serious than it sounds. Like, the classic one is, you know, now I'm 6'3 and about 260 pounds. I was a lot heavier, thankfully. I've lost a bit of weight. For me, meeting someone, the odds are, you know, even though I can't handle myself for heck, most people aren't going to jump me because I look like I can. Most people don't have that clear safety advantage built into them by natural size. Like, when you're meeting a stranger in real life, there are scary factors to it. Like, so to sort of destigmatize and to make people safer, because obviously there's a lot of awful things on the internet, especially online dating, I got to turn it over to you two and give your thoughts on online dating experiences and what it's like meeting a stranger IRL.
Well, I think most ladies anyway would have their safety buddy that they have in WhatsApp or that they text and let them know, like, I'm going to meet a person for the first time. We're going to such and such restaurant or such and such pub, and I should be home by whatever time. If I'm not home, text me, or, and if I don't respond, call the guards.
I have my guy I go to for tasers. If you need a taser, ladies.
The Sunday Business Post is not endorsing the illegal sale of tapes, yeah, just to be clear.
Look, if you handle it correctly, it doesn't kill.
This is
so
true.
Look, you know, I know like there's that statistic, like if you carry a knife, you're more likely to be involved in a knife crime. But there's no statistic about tasers.
Because not too many people carry tasers.
No, there's not. Lies. I'm only joking, by the way. No, I think just tell people. Yeah. And like open space, you know, open space. I remember there was
coffee dates.
Yeah, exactly. Just see them
daylight.
A neutral territory. It's just...
Actually, you mentioned the daylight thing. That is interesting because I noticed. I once said it to a few friends. My dating life tends to be in line with the baseball season, which is when the most daylight is during the year. For those unaware, baseball runs from about March, like I can't when spring training's on, until about the end of September. And so you're right, like the fewer daylight months, because it's basically, you know, that first date, you know, they often want to, you know, and I understand that, like, they want to do something afternoonish, or at least when there's evening light. So
see them in a public place, but don't go to Hampstead Heath.
We are not going down
that
road.
No, I'm just gonna say, there was this guy who, like, on OkCupid when I was living in London, who used to just be like, every time I logged on, he was like insisting I meet him on Hampstead Heath, like just really short notice as well. I was kind of like, are you a serial killer?
Can I get you in the next half hour on Hampstead Heath?
No, like, I don't know, maybe Hampstead Heath is like really nice. I mean, it sounds very middle class, you know. It's
the
like
area
very
is
British
the Heath, not
of,
so much.
Yeah, I just, the idea of meeting a man upon the Heath was a bit like, no.
My brother used to work in a pub there, actually, so the area
really?
Is pretty middle class, but the Heath is dodgy as heck, like,
right,
so that's the best way to describe
why
it.
Why was he so insistent? Like,
did you meet him in the end?
No.
Probably the wise call.
Yeah.
But like, that's the thing about, like, so, you know, do you have to be a bit more, because like, if you, you know, meet somebody, sort of, you meet through a friend, is there a natural sense of security more to that than in real life, or is there a difference?
I think so. Like, okay, so I, since I've seen you guys last, I have gotten out of a 5-year relationship, so I'm kind of new to dating at the moment.
All ahead of you.
It's all ahead of me. But I went on a few kind of, well, one or two like online dates. And the guy that I kind of fancy at the moment, I met through friends. And I like it a lot more. I feel like because we already knew each other, we had hung out a number of times where that wasn't on the cards, like any kind of fancying wasn't really like on the cards. We're just hanging out as friends.
And then you get to discover that. I like that.
And like going out like on a date, we already knew each other. We knew what made each other laugh and stuff. And that just made it so much. And I felt like... going on like a Tinder date or an OkCupid date, it just felt much more forced.
Yeah,
in a way.
Like a business engagement almost.
Yeah, it felt
but
like
where you
a
have
job
to get
interview.
Really drunk.
Yeah.
But then that's not really wise. And in light of like bad things, it's like I think when I think back to when I used to date online more, my main strategy was to just go in and drink a lot from the very start. And actually, that's a really bad idea and won't always work in your favor. At best, you will just embarrass yourself and like scare the man, you know? Like, and at worst, you're putting yourself in a vulnerable position. So
that is the
one
upside of being a commissioning editor. I just have this like army of freelancers, past and present, who, if I know roughly where they live and a date's going bad, I can send the emergency text of, "You need to give me a work call right now. Please.
A work call.
I owe you so much.
Urgent work call."
A meeting of the Business Post must take place.
Because it is awkward, isn't it? Just meeting some stranger. And there's not really much conversation that can be had within the confines of Tinder, actually, as a context. To me, I hate Tinder because the only kind of conversation it seems to encourage is lechery.
Well, that does lead to my second question within this area, which a lot of people have, is the data sharing concerns. Because whatever about OKC and Google getting all your data, if I was to look up one of you two, not knowing you.
All my Ashley Madison accounts. No, I mean, they're all out in the air now.
All 5,000 of them.
If I find you two on OKC, and, you know, your name is reasonably close to your real name, I'm not going to obviously give away either of these young people's profiles and all that. The big thing is, if I have your age, probably, you know, I have your location, roughly. Yeah. I probably have your profession. I'll find your Facebook really fast, or at worst your LinkedIn, and then I'll find your Facebook.
Yeah.
As not me personally, I'm saying if I'm, you know, a terrible person, and I can just know loads about you, so I can go along on this date and pretend, you know, I'm into these things you're into, and it turns out actually I'm just trying to socially engineer you. And that ain't love, baby. That ain't love to anybody.
Oh, there's a brilliant book that came out last year called Sympathy. It was by a really young kind of first-time author, I think, called Olivia Sujik. But it's this girl in New York. She's English. She's over for the summer. And she becomes obsessed with this woman. And she uses the Instagram to basically like reverse engineer a relationship. She's like stalking her across mainly Instagram, but like lots of different social media platforms. And she basically like tries to work out everything that this girl cares about and then just finds a way into her life to like befriend her and then isolate her from everyone she knows and cares about. It's like a story of like obsessive love over social media. And you could totally do that. Like if Patricia Highsmith was alive, I feel like she would be writing that kind of thing now. You know, and the like, talented Mr. Ripley, but with Instagram.
And then because she's a lesbian, everybody dies.
Everybody dies.
Everybody dies.
Yeah.
It's so bad how predictable fiction can be sometimes. But like within that, like, you know, like, because I think about that, and it's kind of, if I was to interview Shauna professionally, I'm going to read up a lot about her. But I also know there are certain lines. You know, it's like, I don't want to find out about her personal life. If I'm meeting you going out, I'm probably not going to do that because I want to be surprised. If I'm interviewing you, I'm not. And like, likewise at Roshi, like, you know, it's like, because you're happening there, we'll go to Emma Toney to be safe here.
But I also think, like, just from a personal point of view, and maybe you'd be the same, like there, if someone messages me on OkCupid or Tinder or whatever, you might go looking up that person anyway, just for safety.
Oh yeah. It's the difference between, like, you know, looking them up for safety and looking a little too much up for safety.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
it is
like,
a
it's,
weird one.
It is an odd one, isn't it? Like, where's the line within? Like,
you know? And also people who kind of spew their guts on the internet. Mm. Like one thing I find really kind of delightful and hilarious is like how unlike their online persona someone can be.
Yes.
That's always quite kind of fun, like just kind of trying to work out, you know, just work out all of the stuff that goes on in
Ewan McKenna, who writes for us, like if you ever look at Ewan's online stuff, and in fairness some of his columns, you'd think he's the most miserable person on the planet.
Right.
And in person he's like a jovial dude.
Well, here I'm gonna be shitting on an ex. I'm not really though. If he's listening, I'm sure he's not. But like I used to date a guy who only wrote confessional writing. Mm-hmm. And I literally just like shouted at him, I think at the end, I was like, don't write about this. Like, don't write about this. But like,
he was Taylor Swift, basically.
Yeah, exactly. But like, even if the person wasn't a writer, like just Twitter is so like, this is the era of curious cat, you know, of basically confessional internet all the time.
My sister likes to post pictures on her or videos on her Instagram of her singing Celine Dion to her dog.
That's lovely.
That's adorable, like.
Yeah.
Like, but just that entire, like, feeling like you need to broadcast your entire
life.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, I love my sister, and I love her dog, and I love Celine Dion, unironically. But, like.
Oh, I do as well. Like, I went through that phase where I pretended it was ironic, and now I accept she's actually just brilliant.
She's amazing.
Yeah. She's very talented. Yeah. I'm glad she's still going as well. Like, she's. Yeah.
Within that, though, I'm thinking as well of. Because tech plays a role in the normal roots of relationships as well, because I'm thinking, like, when you met whoever you're seeing-ish at the moment, like yourself, you probably added them on Facebook, you probably are friends with Instagram, or you might have been already. And like, sort of, you know, that shaped your view of them to some degree, mixing with the real life, but it was sort of, you know, it was distilled by them, but not in this sort of mechanical, commoditized level, which is the next question we're getting to. And it's like, that is the thing, because like, sort of, you know, like I can safely say that prior to the Tinder age, my last three relationships were heavily influenced by Facebook in some way, be it sharing images, chats and that. Like there was something to do with each of the three, you know, last people I'd seen before that. And, you know, but the whole thing was, this was this natural phase of discovery, even though it was still using tech. With OKC, with Bumble, I know we're hopping on OKC a lot, but they are the percentage one. At least with Bumble, it's like, you know, to me, it's at least it's safer girls. Sorry, women. Sorry. I don't try and confuse terms. My apologies. Please don't kill me in the comments. It's like, you know, it's like.
The women of Bumble.
The women of Bumble. But the key point of getting that there is like, sort of, you know, I feel like it was still the labor part, whereas now is dating getting commoditized, sort of? Like, is it becoming too much of a straight... Obviously, it's a business for the apps, but it's almost like it's becoming a business for the user.
And we treat ourselves like products a little bit.
Yeah, are we
the
product?
Everything's being commoditized. It's not just love. It's not just sex. It's everything.
It's identity. It's our sense of selves, because we allow very corporate parts of the internet to interfere with how we see ourselves.
It's scary how, pinpoint, like, laser accurate my sponsored posts are coming up in my
They're getting
Instagram.
A lot better in a scary way.
They're getting really, really good, and that terrifies me. Absolutely terrifies me. Yesterday it was the National Birds of Prey Center up in Wicklow.
That's lovely.
I really
you just get like hawks tearing apart mice, well, you know, like, on your Instagram.
Like, it was like a picture. No. It was like a picture of an owl, and I was like, oh my god, I was just thinking about owls like not too long ago, and then it was like sponsored post from the National Bird of Prey Center. I'm like, oh, damn you, Google.
I've noticed what I like to call a 10%. So 90% are basically like that. The 10% is what I call the ones that are clearly influenced by things I've been looking up for work.
I get those as well.
Yeah. It's so funny.
I get so much B2B software.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
Like, I don't have the money for Microsoft 365 or whatever.
Because Roisin definitely would be in this boat because she works for Connect on a regular basis.
I really think the internet thinks like I'm a man who works in an office who's like a C-suite executive of like and is looking for a woman from Ukraine.
Actually, the person I'd love to hear comments from on this who used to write for us is now at Silicon Republic, Ellen Tannen, because Ellen wrote for us for about 6 months. Oh, she's brilliant. You've been on a show with her as well, I think, haven't you? But Ellen, her first thing for us was on network infrastructure. And like first thing she did was go on YouTube looking at videos about network infrastructure. That's very good, by the way. I was very happy she did this. But I'm just thinking, oh my, if she's this diligent with her work, because she is a very diligent worker, I can only imagine how dull some of the ads she gets are, and totally unrelated to her life. So Ellen, if you're listening, please let us know, you know, on Twitter, wherever, you know, do you get some ads that make absolutely no sense to you outside of, you know, being a journalist covering it?
Does clearing your cookies even help with any of that?
I don't know anymore.
Because I was just thinking back to say like that Black Mirror episode. I would love the chance to just start over a few times during my life, or even maybe once a year or something, to get like, to download maybe a footprint or like a pie chart or something of who I am to Google, and then tell them where they're wrong and be like, right, well, going forward, I won't care about network infrastructures. And
just basically saying to Google, you don't know me.
Yeah, bitch, you don't know me. And this is not my relationship status. And I don't even like that. I just had to write about it. And, you know, like, I would
love
that.
But then there's a question of the invasion again, though, because if the AI got smart enough to separate this is a work search, this is a personal search, this is a private personal search, for want a better way of phrasing it, like, that means it's knowing a little too much about you again as well.
Well, there's
though,
nothing private
it?
Left then, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what's the self in the age of encryption? You know, should we just be keeping little bits of the internet to ourselves, or should we just abide in the sanctity of our minds and our bodily fluids?
Well, we are moving on slightly topic-wise, because Shauna brought up, it's definitely an expertise for her because of the person involved. And it's two things. I saw you write about Erica Lustus's project. She's a famous porn actress, slash director as well, isn't she?
She's not a porn actress. She's a director.
She's only a director. My apologies, Erica.
She was kind of like the first feminist porn director, like big time, wasn't she?
On her level, yeah. I mean, there's lots of...
There's been loads before her, but...
There's been loads before her.
One of the things I saw you mentioning before, but before I get to this project she's working on, is she's also working as well on the whole trying to get people to like, well, pay for their porn, because... Because this is the thing, it's like... And obviously, if you've still got the kids listening to this, what are you doing? So it's like, but there is an actual economics factor here as well. Like, you know,
absolutely. It's not just her. Again, like, there is a whole swathe of like feminist porn directors and producers who are trying to get people to pay for their goddamn porn. We expect everything to be free, but it just undercuts the producer, the performers, everyone who works behind the scenes, just undercuts their work. Actually, John Ronson has a 6-part like podcast called The Butterfly Effect, and talking about Pornhub and how Pornhub just absolutely disseminated the porn industry.
Oh my god, and I must see that.
Before the listeners kind of going, oh, come on, it's like, if you know anything about the history of media, porn is the bellwether for everybody else. When porn started going free, suddenly, you know, that's when you saw the likes of, you know, print media suddenly come under pressure, like, you know, and broadcast media come under pressure because of expectation of free.
Yeah.
Like, you know, likewise, when it comes to moving onto the internet, they were the big early movers. Like, you know, likewise, VHS, they were big early movers. Like, you look at every era of media evolution, they are the indicator of what's going to happen next, you know, in the last century or so.
It's true. You know, the whole kind of cam girl and cam boy and cam people setup of like, please tip me. You know, please be my friend. I will be the internet's girlfriend.
The Guardian says, seeing as you're here.
Yeah, well, exactly. I feel like that's the model, like, for everything. I mean, I was doing, like, this conference last year, was it? Yeah, it was last year. And, oh my God, I've forgotten his name. Mark, from Storyful.
Mark Little. He used to be there, yeah.
Mark Little. Well, he was like, you know, oh, I see. I asked him about the future of media because I was just asking the most like obvious kind of hammy question, but it is kind of the one that I would like his answer on. And he was like, oh, I see it following a Spotify model where, you know, people just pay to the journalist for what they write, not centralized hubs of journalism. I was kind of like, we'll all just be like cam girls, won't we? Like,
yeah.
I mean, actually, they're ahead of the curve that way. That sort of micro...
But
micro production, I guess.
On the broader project that Eric Liss is working on, just tell us a bit about that.
Like, oh, yeah, sorry.
Sorry. Us going off on tangents, not this show.
Never.
Sorry.
No, sorry about that.
Yeah, so Erica Liss, her whole model of she's getting people to pay and like doing quite well out of it, getting people to pay for much better quality of porn and erotic cinema, erotic storytelling. And so now her latest project, she just announced on Instagram last week, is she wants to get more women into porn. So she wants female filmmakers, and now I'm like on a one-woman mission to try to get female Irish filmmakers.
Non-porn directors.
Non-porn directors.
That's interesting.
You don't have to be a porn director. She just wants to get more people involved in porn to change the industry and, you know, provide like a higher quality of porn. And you have to, so there was a few requirements. You do have to have your own budget. She will help you with like the kind of additional support and making sure like everything you do is legal and like paperwork and all of that. And she'll help, she'll publish it on her website. And there was like a few other things. Oh, and you have to like essentially sign up to her ethics and that like everybody has to be paid a proper wage.
This reminds me of a better Suicide Girls. Like the model of like sort of this is a center, this, you know, you can sort of use this platform to get attention, but you're doing it yourself and you're democratizing it.
Yeah.
Not that they
and the interesting thing as well
way,
is what you're talking about is essentially like instilling these clear, fair working practices, which is again
Probably
an important thing in the media right now.
Yeah, exactly. Or like any creative field.
Yeah.
It's like, so interesting project she's working on. One thing which could interrupt everything we've discussed so far, from commoditized dating to Google's assault on love, to meeting somebody personally via an app, to all the great work being done by Erica Liss, our final topic of this show.
I love how it's written down in the notes.
So, sex robots.
Yes.
I think given the ethical issue around these, a lot of you would have first encountered it, as in a lot of our listeners, with that amazing segment featuring Philip Schofield and Holly Willoughby asking a chap about the sex robot he developed. And it was glorious because Philip Schofield talking about anything that's not run of the mill.
Does he get a bit hot and bothered?
No, it's the whole thing. He gets that he's naff. You know, it's not like Richard Madeley who gets hot and bothered. Philip Schofield is aware he's a naff dude. And he goes, right, so I've got to try and come across even-handed here, even though I'm Philip frickin' Schofield.
Is it true that Philip Schofield tweets a lot about wine?
He's big into his wine. He tweets a lot about wine, yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
I have a friend
winehead.
Who's been like taking the piss out of this for years.
He's mad into his wine. Like, you know, apparently he like, you know, does the distribution stuff and whatever. He's a huge passion project for it.
He's a connoisseur.
And he had a big thing at Christmas. He wore his, like, it was a Snapchat, I think, where he kept on trying to find one of his old, because he's in his old country house, because of course, you know, one of his old...
Oh, he's a cellar probably full of wine.
One of his old smoke alarms kept on going off. And so he thought he had found it, like smashed it violently. The noise was still coming. Turned out there was another old smoke alarm he wasn't aware of.
Schofield!
And like, it ends with him, you know, very sort of, you know, this relieved man face drinking the glass of wine. Oh. So that is nothing to do with sex robots.
So
but
sex
it's still
robots.
So sex robots.
So yeah, they'll look like Philip Schofield.
But Roshan, because you've got a lot of ethical thoughts in this area, I know.
Do I? I don't know. I think I was just thinking about it going in here today, and I was like, well, actually, I mean, so I'm not opposed, like, I'm very for porn, I'm very for horror films, I'm very for just like outside forms of media satisfying human impulses. I think we should, you know, that should be one of the kind of duties of technology. If we're going to have any kind of control over technology, technology should satisfy our needs and desires. And those include food at any hour of the night. I should have food delivered to my home.
Food
and the
and
other
porn.
Orgasms. And really, these are the base things. And I suppose, you know, money and work and these things are also sort of necessary and equality for all human beings and maybe even the cyborgs. But, you know, I wouldn't be that opposed to sex robots, really. I'm more opposed to, like, someone wearing a Google Glass while I have sex with them, you know? I mean, like, a sex robot, on the other hand, it's kind of simple, really, isn't it? It's just, like, satisfying a need.
It's like, you know, that
but
would be...
But, again, it's the question of AI. At what point do they become sentient? Because the thing that you, the thing that you love about having a sexual partner is that they yeah. have their own impulses so and we the want, things that turn them
this
on.
This is why people are so disturbed by the idea of a sex robot, because... And, actually, we already have sex robots, basically. But, like, so purpose-built AI...
I brought
and then,
in a bag.
Exactly. Take them out. Take them out. The general AI and purpose-built AI, or like general robots, purpose-built robots. You know, obviously a sex robot's going to be a purpose-built robot. I mean, like, we're thinking about, like, let's think, she's taken out the vibrator. Very good. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't have problems with it. It's more when you're in a Blade Runner type universe where, like, the robot, which could be a sex robot. There we go. The lovely, soft, soothing hum. Of a sex toy.
I gotta say, with the mic, it's not that soothing, even though I can hear it sort of sans yeah. mic, but the mic is sort of giving you this sort of, you know, the incoming sign of death.
If only it was shaped like Philip Schofield.
If you have Roy Batty in your home, he is going to rebel. You know, he's too good to be a sex bot. He should be leading a robot rebellion. But if you have a vibrator in your home, then what's the problem? If you have a vibrator in your home that looks a little bit more like a robot and that is like a bit more developed 20 years from now, I don't see a problem with that.
To go with the prudish argument that will be given, and I think it's a reasonable one to make, which I would love to hear answers on, is the difference between a vibrator and a robot is clearly meant to be representing a woman as such, as opposed to an act.
But who said it has to be a woman?
Or
why isn't it Philip Schofield?
Well, clearly they've gone after a certain type of straight male market.
Yeah, it's a Schofield real doll.
But like it's a commoditization of the person.
They're always going to market to straight white men first and foremost, before any of our needs.
You know, straight white men can be into some weird shit.
That's very true.
But is it commoditizing the person, is what I'm saying? Because, like, it's one thing if sort of, you know, say an actress in porn or a sex worker.
But that's like saying we can't have effigies of humans.
They have their... We'll get to the efficacy in a second, but I say they have agency, you know, because it's their choice and all that. Like, the robot is clearly implying that, like, you know, the end user sees a woman as a product in some degree. Like, I would love to hear thoughts on that aspect.
So when we get helper robots in the future to, like, help us with our daily, day-to-day tasks, when we get, like, the butler bots or whatever, are we going to have a problem with that because they will live a life of servitude to us? Are we going to care about? I mean, we already have Alexa.
To approve of all of these, it sort of entails having to believe in meat privilege, which I was once accused of by somebody I was dating.
Meat privilege,
which I found very funny, but it's true. I mean, I do have meat privilege. I think we are different to humans, and no matter how like humans, like, robots get, they will never be the same thing as
Hang
us.
Hang on, we are different to humans.
Sorry, robots. Sorry,
I was going to say Roisin Qyburn. Are you a robot?
No, I am a lizard person.
Oh right, sorry.
It's a Pleiadian. I'm a Pleiadian. No. But like, robots will never take our place. So what's the problem? You know, if they have a will of their own and it's like 50 years in the future or whatever, and they're like, please stop using us, you're objectifying us, and actually we're robots.
There are totally going to be like three listeners who like watch the Animatrix and kind of go, don't you realize we caused the robot uprising ourselves?
This is the brain like emoji. The brain meme is like exploding now. Yeah. But no, I mean, like, you know, if the robots develop a will of their own and they don't want to be oppressed and had, you know, and be sex slaves, then we'll have to cross that bridge when we come to it.
Now,
but it's something that we need to think about now, because, and I'm like, obviously pro sex bot, but it's something that we should start thinking about now, because what if we get to a stage in our own human evolution where we are dependent on some form of bot servitude,
right?
And then the robots are like suddenly like, no, we're not dealing with this shit anymore, and we don't want, then we're gonna have to
and to put technology, you know, technology is capable of solving so many problems in the world, like getting Elon Musk to the moon, so we never have to deal with
getting
them
Elon Musk's
ever
fucking
again.
Car to the moon.
We get him to the
it's
to
going
the,
to Mars,
Mars.
Dude.
Yeah. Mars, yeah. No, but like technology, you know, if we put all of our resources into just creating like hypersexualized fantasies of women, I mean, that's obviously a fucking waste of technology. You know,
I hope
I think
considered
Blade
a waste
Runner
anyway.
Was really interesting in that regard, because like the new Blade Runner sort of to me was an allegory about a world without women, where men's like the appetites of straight men had essentially led to the end of the world, you know, and that like the robots were left as these sort of custodians of the apocalypse afterwards. All these robots built to look like male fantasies of women, but actually completely different
It reminds me of a beautiful line from Merry Christmas to Lawrence. We are all victims of men who think they are right.
It's so true.
You know, it's like, it's so true. Yeah. Great film. Tom Conti is one of the laziest actors going, though. I mean, not when he acts, but he just does so few projects or did. I'm not sure if he's still alive, but he was a comical, like, you know, he was like Day-Lewis without the Day-Lewis cred, you know, in terms
going
of
going to see Phantom Thread tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
Mm. I'm excited. Yeah.
Or technically, a few days ago, because you're listening to this.
In the past!
Yeah. Shauna, I do want to ask you about sort of this season for Sex Shop, though, because this is like one of your, this is basically your Christmas, essentially.
This is my Christmas. Well, Christmas is my Christmas. I actually do better at Christmas than I do at Valentine's Day. Yeah.
One thing I'd love to ask about is, do you see a difference in type of things being demanded this time of year, like versus the rest of the year, or is just more of it?
Typically, if there is a 50 Shades movie coming out, like there is.
Are you selling merch?
More like bondage gear.
Okay, right.
Yeah. And I don't have that much on the site, but like there's like some beginner's bondage kits and stuff like that that do particularly well when a 50 Shades movie is out. But for the most part, it's kind of, I think I've built up a nice little following, a nice little community that like if there's a toy that I really love and I push it online, like people will generally trust me that it's a good toy.
That's it, because you've come, like, you know, you're a purely digital business right now and you have been from the start.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you've built yourself. We were talking about this before you came in. Like, we're checking how many followers you got on Instagram. Because, like, Shauna's Instagram story was her dancing in her living room.
Creeping on your Instagram.
Before, like, coming out to record this show. I was kind of going, she's got 2K followers. It's amazing. Like, you know.
And,
it's like,
and oh. She accepts Bitcoin. I was told this
by
someone.
I do accept Bitcoin. I was one of the first retailers, not just sex toy retailers, but just one of the first retailers in Ireland to accept Bitcoin.
Blazing a trail.
Mm-hmm. And, like, so have you found there's more smart tech coming into the stuff you sell?
You had. I remember you talking about
this.
Are
there more app-enabled toys? Basically,
yeah. So the app-enabled toys a couple years ago started coming out, and it was the big trendy thing that like all of the toys are going to be app-enabled, and it's so great because now if you're in a long-distance relationship, if someone is living in LA and your partner's living in London, you can fuck over the internet, and then. The shit hit the fan. Some hackers in New Zealand discovered that in one brand in particular, a really, really good and well-respected brand called WeVibe, their app-enabled toys were very easily hackable, which threw up loads of questions about, like, is that considered a sexual assault if I am masturbating with a vibrator and someone hacks into it and fucks around with the settings? I did not consent to that. So not only that, they also discovered that WeVibe were collecting tons of data on the usage of the vibrators that they sold. So things like what time of day people were using their vibrators, the intensity levels, the different speeds and stuff. The most disturbing one was the temperature of the vibrator, which they claim is for diagnostic purposes only. And it probably is. It just sounds... The optics aren't good.
Yeah, the optics are not good. There should be rules around, like, industry rules around sort of... levels of invasion. I mean,
yeah.
I guess
so
it's
and the thing is, it was in their terms and conditions. Right. As part of like purchasing it, but it was so deeply buried in it and in this like kind of very vague language.
Yeah, no one reads
that. No one would read it, and so they ended up having a class action lawsuit being brought against them, which they lost last year, and they ended up having to pay out $4 million. Canadian dollars to their North American customers. The European customers weren't part of the class action.
Well, our neighbor for SVP Towers is Ms. Helen Dixon, the Data Protection Commissioner. Helen, you thought your job with the GDPR coming up was going to be fun. It just got a lot more fun. And on that note, we sadly, because we've hit the hour mark, folks, have to bring it to an end to our annual special. But before we go, I do have to let both my guests plug themselves heartily. I'll start off with Roisin, because Sean has far more things to tell you. Roisin, where can people find you on the internet? Where
Hello.
You want them to find you, just to be clear.
Oh, no, not Ashley Madison. No, I'm not actually on Ashley Madison. I'm on Twitter, Roisin Kybird, Roisinkibeord. And that's about it, really. I also write Kindle singles, erotic Kindle singles about piracy.
Do you?
No, I don't. I have a friend who does, though.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a real thing. You can make money at it.
Awesome. And you also write for Motherboard still. Yeah?
I do. I write for Motherboard, and I write for the Sunday Business Post, and I also do book reviews that have nothing to do with sex robots.
Yet. Yeah. Wait till Nadine hears this episode, then she'll probably... Yeah. Say, yeah, no, still no sex robots.
Send me all the sex robot books.
Yeah, it's like She'll probably go, Emma, what are you doing? And Shauna, please.
Hi. or goodbye, really. I don't know why I'm saying hi. So yeah, my social media handles are at SexShoppa for Twitter and Instagram. And you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/theshoppa. I have lots of sex toys that you can buy for your sweetie or your...
Yourself or your fuck buddy.
Or your random plaything.
Or the person that you're going to get as the third for your special Valentine's Day three-way. And yeah, and I give talks about sex and sex toys. So you can hire me if you want me to give a talk or if you want me to write about sex toys and sex and relationships.
And she's really good at those talks, by the way, just to let you all know. It's like, I've really got to thank both my guests for coming in, because this is easily one of the most fun things we do every year on this show, and also in the post, is the Valentine's Day thing. So Roisin Kyburn and Shauna Scott, thank you both for joining us here.
Thanks
on Connected.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us.
As ever, Connected is brought to you in association with Dell EMC, who I am always grateful for the support of, but really because they give me the editorial freedom to do stuff like this. So thanks to Dell EMC as always for your support of Connected, and thanks to all of you and the Cult of Connected for tuning in again. We have two more shows coming up, which they are interesting. They're very different to this. I can't tell you what they are, but we actually are both recording both of them the day after we record this, so which is why we've got to be super secret about what they are right now, because there's like a week before another one and another week before the other. But two very different areas covering two definitely very different areas of tech, although both kind of link in. Not really at all to this, but I'm going to try and throw away, make you think that we do. So until next time, y'all look after yourselves. Have a great V-Day, or Valentine's Day, as people call it. I just think always of, VE Day, VJ Day, all that. And until next time, I'll keep being Emmett Ryan.